We are beginning the last chapter of the Gospel of John. We've been going through this book, and we had completed the main part of the book, but we're starting that last chapter, which has some interesting things in it. And so the title that I've used today is A Lesson from Fishing. And this prompted me to think about some things from my own experience in the past. So I am going to foist on you some personal trivia remembrances. When I was a kid, like elementary and middle school, I was very much into fishing. Did you know that? I had forgotten it. Actually, it's been a while. My brother Rich and I, brother just younger than me, we would ride our bikes down to the creek, and it wasn't too far away, a mile or two maybe, and bring our fishing poles, and we would catch rainbow trout up in Linden, Washington area, on the creek that ran into the Nooksack River that flowed down from Mount Baker. And I remember usually catching fairly small ones. Sometimes we'd have to get out the fish stretcher to get it just long enough to make it 6 inches so you could take it home and cook it. But usually they were within that range. But once I caught a 12-inch rainbow trout, and I pulled it out of the creek and went flying up in the air, and it landed on the road because I was fishing from the road, the Hennigan Road little bridge that went over it, and caught that fish, and boy, that was a 12-inch trout. I mean, that was just amazing. And we would eat what we caught. Our mother would help with preparing it to cook it. We would prepare it in terms of just cleaning the fish and all of that. I also used to participate in a local fishing derby and even caught a good one. I caught a winner, and I think I won a little tackle box. So that was a memory as well. And then there was this occasion in 1968 in the summer. It was, I think, the day that Robert F. Kennedy was shot, if you remember that day. And we were just leaving on a trip to Michigan to visit family back there. And I was, we were planning to stay at a cottage on Green Lake in just south of Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I was anticipating fishing when I got there, brought the pole, and I was really smart because I brought a can of worms along. And we were wondering about a day and a half into the trip why it was smelling bad in the car. About partway into Montana, we decided, oh, the worms are not doing well. I guess we can do without them. Maybe they'll have worms in Michigan, which they did. But when my brother and I went fishing in Michigan on Green Lake, I do recall we got seriously sunburned because we hadn't anticipated that the sun shines there sometimes in the summer. And I fished a few times in Lake Michigan when we lived in Traverse City with some of the people from church who had boats that would take us out. And so I got to fish a little bit in the last while. But I still have my fishing pole, the same pole from all those years ago. But it has been sitting dormant for years now. So anyway, I bring all this up because the lesson today brings back some fishing memories. And this occasion was memorable, I suspect, for the disciples as well. As we think about this final chapter of the Gospel of John, we are reminded that the book began with a prologue, a theological prologue, verses 1 through 18. Very strongly theological in terms of what it was communicating there. Now it's going to end with a practical epilogue. And so John had basically concluded his narrative in chapter 20, and that was intended to bring unbelievers to faith in Jesus Christ. And chapter 21 is essentially instruction for those who have come to faith in him, for his disciples, and that it gave them some direction on serving him in order to carry out the mission that he had given them in chapter 20, verses 21 to 23. And this last chapter also carries up on some of the other themes that have been found in this book. So this text includes another appearance of Jesus, but now it's in the Galilee region, not in Jerusalem, right immediately after, but a little bit thereafter. And after returning from Jerusalem in the Passover celebration, they came back to their home area. And Jesus is going to show up here, which indicates that he did not have any mobility limitations. He was able to get around from place to place. And we're not told how he did that. But so anyway, now we're going to be looking at this text, the first several verses, first 14 verses of chapter 21. This was an occasion to see another miraculous provision. And we read verses 1 to 3. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and in this way he showed himself. Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." They said to him, "We are going with you also." They went out and immediately got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. I don't know about you, but going fishing and catching nothing is not that much fun. But, as I've seen a sticker on a vehicle, a bad day fishing is better than a good day at work. So, but anyway, you can take that how you like. The disciples returned to what was familiar to them. Well, they went home. That's what you would expect, I think. So they returned to their home area and their friends and were hanging around like they normally would. And so what would you do if you found yourself in that situation? So here we have another post-resurrection appearance of Jesus to his disciples. And it's assumed that it occurred during the 32-day period between Thomas's confession in chapter 20, verse 28, and Jesus' ascension in Acts 1:9. And we don't know exactly when this took place. It's probably not significant to what we're dealing with here, but they were on their home turf. They were Galileans. They were back in Galilee, around the Sea of Galilee area. And it's interesting that John was the only New Testament writer to refer to the Sea of Galilee as the Sea of Tiberias, which would have been a broader, more cosmopolitan terminology, as opposed to the local folks. He called it the more general term because of the Roman influence there, and the city that was on the shores that was referred to as, or the name was changed to Tiberias, and so he was referring to it in that way. And using that original, or that name that his original readers would have recognized, because he was speaking later and to a broader audience. So I think that makes good sense. So John stressed the fact that Jesus revealed or manifested himself through this gospel, and that's clear throughout. Now Jesus gives another revelation of himself to his disciples, and they will learn some more about him, something new that comes through in this revelation as well. John identified the disciples who were present on this occasion. Five of them are given their names, and the other two were anonymous. We're not sure who those were. The way it's indicated here seems to suggest that Peter was viewed or recognized as the apparent leader. This was in spite of his earlier denial prior to this. Thomas was obviously a believer in Christ's resurrection now, and so he was part of this event. Also, there's a reference to Nathanael and connects him to Cana in Galilee. And Cana was mentioned in chapter 2, where the wedding took place. Perhaps this was to remind the reader of that previous event that was referenced in this book. Then the sons of Zebedee were James and John, though John hadn't identified himself in this way before. But it may have been John's way of hinting at his own presence there as an eyewitness, which he has referenced a couple of different times previous to this. And so with the two unnamed disciples, this makes a total of seven that were here at this time. And it's likely that this exact number was given in order to add credibility to this account. Again, the eyewitness idea is given here. And so this would be a lesson that would have some value, not just for these seven, but for all disciples, those that were a part of the formal 11, soon to be added a 12th, and then Paul eventually later. They return to their familiar profession. Now, there are some who look at this story and they think that what Peter is indicating here, that he's giving up following Jesus, he's not going to do that anymore, so he's going to go back to his old profession. That may be reading more into it than is necessary. All it's indicating is that he is going to go fishing. If I were to say to Susan, "I'm going fishing," first of all, she would say, "What? You haven't gone fishing in years." And then she would want to go along so that she could clean the fish, I'm sure. No, that would not be it. So it's not that unusual to say, "Hey, I'm going to go fishing." And it's something that he used to do. It would have been familiar, and there may have been other reasons for it. He's just in indicating his intention to go fishing, not that he's going to change his vocation back to that. I mean, it doesn't preclude that as a possibility, but the implication isn't necessarily that's what he's going to do. I suspect it's more a matter of he just didn't want to sit around and do nothing. We're supposed to wait for the Lord, so let's do something productive here. And it may be that he was wanting to get some fish so that they could have something to provide for family. I mean, there's a number of different ways of considering that. Maybe something that he just enjoyed doing, although fishing through the night doesn't sound like that much fun to me, but some people apparently, of course, he'd been used to doing it anyway. So there's probably some reason for that. And Peter had already met Jesus prior to this, if we understand the text previously. And so he was aware of his being there. Jesus had told them to meet him in the Galilee, and so that is apparently what they are planning to do. So Peter says, "Let's go fishing." The others say, "Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Let's go do that." And there's a reference to the boat that may indicate that it was one that was in their possession, that they had. May have been Simon's boat in the past, or it could have been someone that they know. It doesn't really say. And so it seems like they were setting about doing what they were familiar with and what they could do. They had the resources, the wherewithal, and it would be something to do during this time that would be productive. And it seems to me that that's not a bad thing. They were, you know, redeeming the time. Then looking at verses 4 to 7, we read, "But when the morning had now come, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Then Jesus said to them, 'Children, have you any food?' They answered him, 'No.' And he said to them, 'Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some.' So they cast, and now they were not able to draw it in because of the multitude of fish. Therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, 'It is the Lord.' Now when Simon Peter had heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had removed it, and plunged into the sea." Again, an interesting picture of not only the immediate context there, but also of the way Peter functioned. He was an interesting character. The disciples were unsuccessful until receiving helpful advice. So the disciples had to admit their lack of success. They had been fishing through the night. They're now nearing the shore. They've had no success. It's always disappointing when you come back empty from a fishing expedition. And they noticed someone on the shore. They didn't recognize that it was Jesus, initially at least. And apparently it was within shouting distance. And why they didn't recognize him could have been a number of factors. It may have been it wasn't light enough to. It may have been the distance was such that they couldn't make him out. It might have been something about Jesus' appearance that was altered in some way. Perhaps some have suggested because of what he had been through before, or maybe a combination of factors were involved here. And so Jesus addressed the disciples with what we would consider somewhat of an affectionate masculine greeting. It's paideia in the original. The translation might be carried on for us to say, "Hey boys, how you doing? You know, did you catch anything?" And so it would have been just a sort of a generic reference in that regard. I think that kind of catches the spirit of the word. And he asked them the question, and the form of the question expects a negative answer. "Have you any food?" Or we might say, "You don't have any food, do you?" they haven't caught any to this point. So they had, apparently he knew that they hadn't caught anything. And so why is he asking the question if he already knew, based on how the question was asked? And I suspect that it may have been to get them to recognize their lack of success in trying to do it on their own. That's not an unusual picture that Jesus has addressed in the past. And it could have been the way the question was asked. It could have been if they didn't recognize who it was, they may have been thinking, "Oh, this is somebody who wanted to buy some fish. Did you catch anything?" Or maybe they're just curious, but it seems that that could have been the thinking that was in view. But it seems like in the answer that the disciples give, there may be a sense of discouragement or even mild embarrassment. I mean, what kind of fisherman are you? If you go fishing, you don't catch anything. It reminds me of when I had gone fishing with one of the guys up in Traverse City, and he had his own boat and his own fishing service that he did on the side. As a matter of fact, he took the Red Wings hockey team out fishing on a couple of different occasions, so he rather enjoyed doing that. But his thing that he would always say is, "We don't go fishing, we go catching." And as far as I know, he pretty well lived up to that, so he was actually pretty good at it. So it's Brian Springstead, Traverse City, Michigan, if you want to go catching instead of just fishing. I think he's still there doing it. So I think it may be that Jesus was working the circumstances here in such a way that the disciples were doing what they normally would do, what they had experience in, what they were good at, and they're going out to do it, and they realize, "I guess we don't have it anymore. We're not catching. We didn't get anything." That's discouraging. And so it's almost as if Jesus wanted them to fail so that they could realize that they need him. That's a possibility. And I think sometimes we find eventually benefit in failure because we recognize our own inadequacy. And that could be a good thing. I mean, sometimes we perhaps too often try to keep our children from failure because we don't want them to fail. But on the other hand, sometimes that's a good thing. And sometimes the Lord allows us to fail in something or another because it's good for us. There's benefit in it. We realize our own inadequacy. We recognize a need for Christ's enablement by His Spirit, that sort of thing. So the disciples were given a simple instruction. They were instructed to move their nets to the other side. Their nets had been hanging on the left side of the boat, and now He's telling them to put them on the right side. And I'm sure there are those who have read this and said, yeah, that's just a good reminder. Don't go left, go right. Okay. I don't think that's what the point was. You can deal with that in your own way. But the suggestion, I mean, these are experienced fishermen for the most part, and they kind of know how to put the net out, and what difference does it make if you put it out on this side of the boat or that side of the boat? I mean, how much difference can there be? Now, if you've ever gone fishing, don't tell me you've not tried that. So I'm not catching it on this side of the boat. I'm going to go to the other side because, hey, it worked for these guys. Why wouldn't it work for me? So he gives them this instruction, and they try it. They actually do it. They've been fishing all night. They may have even tried it on one side or the other, different ways, but now he's telling them to do it. And so they are open to what he has to say, and they follow the instruction. And then what happens? And we might wonder, why did the disciples follow this order without questioning if they weren't even sure it was him yet by this point? Or maybe they were starting to figure out it must be him, because John indicates that he figured it out. And so they did it, and they had success, and now it's going to be an interesting lesson for them to learn. They tried doing things their old way, the way that they had understood that, you know, from their experience, they were relying on what they've always done, and now Jesus gives them a simple instruction to do it just different than what they were doing it, because he told them to do it. Now just imagine if they were in this boat, in this situation. Jesus told them, put the nets on the other side, and they, in their natural stubbornness, said, no way. We've been fishing all night. We haven't caught anything. It doesn't matter if it's on one side or the other. Forget it. We're done. Now, are there any of us that would have responded that way? Go ahead, admit, how stubborn are you? Most of us are fairly stubborn, actually. But they obeyed, and they experienced the success from being obedient. And there are times when we need to be reminded of that as well. We are inclined to do things our own way, to do what we want. And sometimes the Lord has to remind us that there is a better way if we do it His way. And this was just a minor little thing, but yet it was a lesson for them to learn, to take Jesus at His word. And that's a lesson for us as well. Then Peter responded with typical uninhibited enthusiasm. Now we understand the reference to the disciple whom Jesus loved was John. That's the most reasonable explanation of who that is. And we also see something here that John realized something about Jesus before Peter did. He sensed that a miracle had happened and may have remembered that a few years earlier Jesus had performed a similar miracle, Luke chapter 5, 1 to 11. And so there's sort of a picture that emerges here of the distinction between John and Peter. And John seems to have quick insight, and Peter is quick in action. Now, it's kind of convenient if they both work together. If you have good insight and then action, follow that. But that is interesting. So another lesson here for followers of Jesus is that when he grants success to our labors, especially in the sharing of the gospel, we should remember the response that John had. It is the Lord. It's not me that's doing it. It's the Lord. How else can you explain those results? And so they obviously were able to put that together. And so apparently Peter had learned something, that John's instincts about things were better than his. And so he accepted John's conclusion and jumped into the water. And he was eager to get to see Jesus. And he assumed he could do it faster by trudging through the water in some way, rather than waiting for the boat full of fish to get to shore. And so his thinking process, his focus, his priorities seems to have changed from a concern about catching fish to getting to Jesus as soon as possible. And it may cause us to wonder, why would he do that at this point? Was he being simply impulsive here? Well, he had the presence of mind to put on his outer garment. Of course, now we would think, well, wait a minute, you're jumping in the water. Why would you put your garment on? Because he wanted to have it on when he got to shore, and it was probably easier than trying to carry it in some fashion, but who knows. So it seems like he was anticipating that. He would have been wearing a base layer, as we would call it, that he was working in, and then had the outer garment. It wasn't his underwear, in case you were wondering that. It would have been, the word that's used there referenced a sort of a long shirt that would have been in place there. So anyway, he was preparing to come to shore, but why was he so eager to get to shore? I would suggest that he was intent on demonstrating his loyalty to the Lord in light of his previous failures. It is as if to say, I don't care what else is going on, I'm going to be loyal to you because I messed up before. It seems like that may be part of the picture, because the rest of the chapter is going to deal with that. Not saying it expressly, but that's the essence of it. And you can imagine that he is still carrying in the back of his mind that sense of shame from his denials, that he's trying to work beyond. And this is a move in that direction. So this was an occasion to see another personal presentation, verses 8 and 9. But the other disciple came in the little boat. Other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from land, but about 200 cubits, dragging the net with fish. Then, as soon as they had come to land, they saw a fire of coals there, and fish laid on it, and bread. So this is nice. There's breakfast prepared for them after being out all night, so that's convenient. So the disciples worked to contain the large catch of fish. They had to deal with what they had now in their hands that they didn't have before. The disciples focused on the practical need of the moment. At least some of them sensed that, hey, we better do something with this. We've got all these fish now. So they were struggling with it. His record of distance here, about 200 cubits or about 100 yards, and then there was the labor involved in dragging the net with the number of fish. And the way that John states this, again, indicates that he was an eyewitness to these events, and it validates the historicity of this event. And they noticed an immediate opportunity to use their catch. While the other disciples struggled to get their net to shore, Jesus was preparing breakfast for them. And John notes here that it was a charcoal fire. And it's a word here that's reminiscent of the same word that Peter was warming himself by when he was making his denials. Is that incidental? John does use the same word, looking back to chapter 18, verse 18. And it seems that Jesus was setting the stage for a lesson that he was going to deal with Peter, as we'll see in the next section that we come to. The traditional site where this took place is a place called Tabgha, on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee between Capernaum and Gennesaret. And, of course, we recognize that the bread and the fish were common staples, and they had been referenced at various times before in the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000. And so they noticed that he already provided a fish. The fish that Jesus had was singular. And so that helps to keep in view that Jesus didn't have a whole bunch of fish. He had one, and he had some bread. And so he's going to be asking for some more of the from what they've caught. So here Jesus is providing for his disciples, giving them breakfast when they had been out struggling, trying to catch fish throughout the night. He had a warm fire going, breakfast, and he was not oblivious to their physical needs at this point. And he knew what their needs were, and he was personally concerned about them. So then we read in verses 10 and 11, Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you have just caught." Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to the land, full of large fish, 153, and although there were so many, the net was not broken. Because you can imagine, if it's a pretty good-sized amount, that could be problematic. The request for more fish encouraged a heroic effort. The request of Jesus related directly to their recent activity. Even though there was already one fish on the fire, again, singular, Jesus instructed the disciples to bring some of the fish, and that was plural, that they had just caught. And he would not provide for their physical need by multiplying, because he's done that before. He could have just had the one fish and multiplied it, because that had happened on a previous occasion. But here he utilized what they had caught, but through a miraculous catch. So I think it's always interesting that the miracles that Jesus did were almost always different in how they were done. Why is that significant? Because if it was always done the same way, then what would we assume? If we just did the same thing that Jesus did, then we could do the same thing ourselves. But this, I think, is just a reminder that it's not the formula, it's not the particular manner in which he does it, it's because of who he is. And that's the real factor. So anyway, it was in the process of providing for them, utilizing what they had just caught, and I think that's an interesting picture of what how Jesus was providing for them. The response of Peter suggests a desire to regain approval, and I think that is really the case. There may be some question as to whether Peter just left the others and said, "Hey, I don't care about you. You guys can handle all the fish," because he does come back to most likely assist them in the bringing on of the fish, but he was already up on shore. He was coming back and likely was pulling it in. They may have been pulling it around the edges to bring it in as well. And then there have been many allegorical explanations regarding the 153 fish. And most of them are too involved to bother with, so I'm not going to tell you all what those are. You can imagine. You can make up your own, because lots of people have. Why 153? Some of these involve gematria. That's the discipline of deriving a word or words from the Hebrew, or in this case, the Greek letters, and representing the numbers. And so it's really pretty fanciful. You can come up with whatever you want. One of the maybe more credible explanations goes something like this. Jesus formerly told his disciples that they would become fishers of men. That was an obvious metaphor, looking back to Mark 1:17. And if the fish here represent the converts that Jesus would miraculously provide for his disciples to catch, perhaps their large number represents many converts. That's at least leaning perhaps in a direction that might be considered. Though personally, I think it was basically a matter of John recording the actual number to provide authenticity to what had happened. It's historical. We counted them. There are 153. Now, most fishermen count their fish. And they're usually fairly good at it. I remember I always would, because I could say, I caught so many fish. And then you would usually tell them how long they were. That's a different story. The length, they can be anything, because you can make up stuff. Because that can vary a great deal from whatever reality is. You're familiar with that. Then verse 12 of John 21, Jesus said to them, "Come and eat breakfast." Yet none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. Now that's an interesting way of stating that. The disciples were still processing all of the recent events. Jesus invited the disciples to join him for breakfast. He was essentially hosting them, providing for them. It's going to be a context for some discussion here as well. And this provision of hospitality was something that indicated a concern for them. And so he was showing himself to be concerned about them and addressing their physical need, but he's going to also be dealing with some spiritual concerns here in just a little bit. So we can imagine that they would have had a chance to get by the fire. Since their climate is not too different from what ours is here, you can imagine at night it's chilly. And if you jump into the water in that kind of environment, in your clothes, like Peter did, he might have a need to dry himself off with a warm fire and get some warm food. That might be a nice thing. So Jesus is providing here just a good example of caring for people that he had concern for. The disciples were still wrestling with Jesus' identity. Apparently, the disciples were wanting to ask, "Who are you? Are you really Jesus, the one that we know and love and have committed ourselves to and are following?" So there was still an element of tension, of some uncertainty, of wanting some sort of confirmation. But then John says, "But they knew it was." What does that say? Well, it says that we can intellectually recognize that something is true, but yet emotionally we haven't caught up yet. And that happens. I mean, you just think about it with the events of this past week with Mike Beavis. Intellectually, I know he's gone and with the Lord. But emotionally, I'm still struggling with did this really happen? How can this be? It's just kind of how it is. And I think that's what they're experiencing here as well. They're still trying to make some sense of this. And there could be some element of the marring that he had from the crucifixion and all of that that affected his look, which is a possibility too. But I think they're intellectually understanding, but still emotionally struggling. And that's not uncommon, as we well know. And then verses 13 to 14. Jesus then came and took the bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. This is now the third time Jesus showed himself to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. So Jesus took the initiative to provide breakfast for the disciples. Jesus saw to the practical needs that they had. He was concerned about them. He knew what they needed. He provided it for them. There's a sense here, I think, that's maybe helpful for us sometimes. When we want to share the gospel, we want to communicate the love of Christ, sometimes we do well to attend to a physical need, so that we've got a connection, so that that need is taken care of, and then they may be in a better place to be responsive to the spiritual need that they have. So, and I think you could argue that may be part of the picture here as well. This was another formal presentation of Jesus to them. And so John concludes this narration here by indicating that this was the third instance of Jesus' personal manifestation to the disciples after the resurrection. And this would have been a formal presentation to the disciples, as the two other formal ones have been. That doesn't negate any of the other occasions, because there have been other ones as well. Chronologically, this would have been the seventh overall of the post-resurrection appearances, if you look at all of them in the different passages. So this is just recognizing that, and was certainly the third one in John's presentation as well. So John viewed this appearance as further proof of Jesus' resurrection, which was necessary. There needed to be validation of that. And he's indicating his personal testimony here again, and using terminology that suggests that he saw it, which he tells us in other places as well. And so here Jesus is taking this occasion to remind these disciples of lessons that he's taught them previously and that were important to remember in view of their mission. He says, as the Father sent me, so send I you. That's the one that he did just recently given here. And this is setting the stage for another lesson that's coming up in the remainder of this book. And so there are lessons here that we can pick up as well. Caring for physical needs as well as spiritual needs. Helping us to know that he can provide for us in unexpected ways, that we can trust him and utilize the resources that he has available to us, to recognize him for who he is, so that we can let others know as well. And the question we can ask ourselves is, have we learned these lessons yet?